Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have an assortment of programs today.
Oh, before we go on, we should note that today is the 11th day of the 11th month.
Right.
And it's not yet the 11th hour, but
that's
for those people who are concerned about veterans and all that kind of stuff, we hope you'll have a day of remembrance. And we'll certainly be joining you in doing that because we had our own sacrifice during that period. So it's hard to say Happy Veterans Day or Armistice Day, but it's an important day, and we all recognize, as I say, the vast sacrifice that was made by our fighting men across the globe, celebrated on the day when the First World War ended in 1918. For those of you who didn't know.
Uh-huh.
The 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month was when they signed it. So
exactly.
Somebody was into 11s, I guess. Anyway, that aside, we have a much more enjoyable subject for the rest of today's program. Two really good books about cookies coming just in time for you to learn how to make cookies for Christmas. And then starting out, two well-loved, oft-ignored subjects. Not exactly the same, but you'll see, or more correctly, I guess, you can hear.
Listeners, welcome a new classic and an absolutely essential book for your kitchen called Roots, the Definitive Compendium, with more than 225 recipes. And we're going to be talking to this remarkable author, Diane Morgan. Congratulations, Diane.
And this is not Diane Morgan meets Alex Haley, just to make it very clear. This is about things that are in the ground, sometimes very deep in the ground, I understand. Thoreau planted his potatoes like 4 feet deep in the sand.
Yes.
You know what I like? I like your moment of sudden revelation about root vegetables when you were at the farmer's market. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, I'd love to. It was really the inspiration for the book. I was at the Portland Farmer's Market. I go almost every Saturday, and this was a couple weeks before Thanksgiving, and I was bags already weighted down with squashes and winter beans, and I was buying celery root. And this woman stopped me, and she said, "What are those?" And I said, "Oh, this is celery root." And said, "Yes, it's kind of ugly looking, isn't it?"
It is certainly
big,
ugly.
Grapefruit size root with
dirt.
With kind of blondish skin, but it tends to have some green running through it and these gnarly roots that are often encrusted with dirt. And she said, "What do you do with it?" And I said, "Well, you can mash it, you can cube it and roast it." I said, "But you can also eat it raw. And it's wonderful in a classic French salad, the celery remoulade." And she went on her way, and I paid for my celery root, and I walked up to another stall, and I picked up this long, dark-colored stick of a looking root, and I turned to the farmer and I said, "What is this?" And he said, "Oh, that's burdock root." And I said, "What do you do with it?" And he proceeded to tell me how to cook it and how to prepare it. And I'm walking back to my car and I'm thinking, wow, I'm a cooking professional and I don't know burdock root and this woman doesn't know celery root and I want to think about root vegetables. And so I started looking in my library of cookbooks and went to a bookstore and went online and realized there wasn't the cookbook that I wanted. I wanted a book that had every root vegetable in it. I wanted to know all about it, the history and lore, how to prepare it, what the nutrition was, what are the best ways to store it, and I wanted a lot of recipes for that root. And so I decided to write the book that I wanted to own. So it was sort of a fish project
you
that I hoped
that
a lot of other people were interested in, too.
But you did all of that, and it's just amazing how you could get all this information. And the recipes themselves are delicious also. You are a veteran cookbook writer anyhow, and food writer. Is this your 17th, or have you already done it?
Yeah, this is my 17th book.
17th book. But I bet, this really outshines almost anything, right?
Well, I tend to take subjects and go deep, but I've never... Probably except for my book that I wrote on salmon, I've never done the extent of research. They've mostly been recipe-driven books with a theme like the Thanksgiving table. But in this case, it took a lot of research, and I really sort of had to study botany to figure out some of these roots and some that are called many things depending on how they're used globally. And it was confusing at times, and it wasn't until I got to the botanical names that I knew I was dealing with the same root, even though it was called something else one country versus another.
I don't know how you'd even sort of discuss the things that I always got confused about with the root and the corms and all those things. I mean, you sort all that out.
Right. There's different ways in which roots grow, and so I needed to figure that out so that I could categorize them properly. Like ginger and turmeric are rhizomes, potatoes are tubers, and so it was, okay, like, let's make sense of all this versus something that's like a true tap root, which is beet or carrot or celery root. They don't necessarily have to be, we think of tap roots as being maybe these long tapered roots, and they don't have to specifically be that shape. They can be round. But some of them are long, skinny roots. So it became fascinating to me to understand this, but then that was a different thread of research.
Well, I've been in food most of my entire life, and there are things in here I've never even heard of, let alone tasted. And my mother used to go on at great length about this burdock root. Now, is there any other part of the plant you eat?
No, but the root is really long. We have wonderful Asian markets in Portland, and they're selling it at the farmer's market. And so sometimes I see it, and it's like almost a yardstick long root. And sometimes at the farmer's market, it's maybe more like 14 or 18 inches long. I was astonished when I bought it at the farmer's market, how long it was.
Well, I've got to lay hands on some of that. And I never heard of crow's nest.
Oh, funny, I should have put the pronunciations in. It's crones, and they're original to Japan and China, and they found their way to Europe, and the French fell in love with them. And 3 years ago, my husband and I were over in Lyon, France at Christmas time because our daughter was teaching over there for a nine-month stretch. And we had an apartment, and we went shopping, and there were crones in a bin next to the potatoes and onions as if they were as common as could be. I was thrilled because I had to hunt them down in the U.S. to try to research them and then cook with them. And so I bought them over there and cooked them over there, and I never would have been able to do that without having been already well into researching the book, because I wouldn't have known what they were.
They look like worms.
They do, but they're incredible.
It looked like you'd see in a Central American market, like in Guatemala.
Well, I try to be sort of kind describing them and say they look like little Michelin men, but they do look like grubs. But they don't taste like grubs, and they're incredibly delicious. They kind of have this nutty, crunchy texture to them and flavor. I love them, and the French adore them, and they turn them into fritters, and they saute them, and they were a true delight, and I actually got a farmer in Willamette Valley to grow them for me.
Oh, that's brilliant. Now, I have a couple of questions. It might seem like silly little questions, but in England, there's a thing grown called a Swede.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot like a turnip, but it's not.
It's a rutabaga.
And in this country, they're called rutabagas. Now, which is the right word?
Well, but see, that was sort of where it took botany book, because they're called many different roots are called many different things depending on where you live. And so the Swede is the name for them if you're over in Europe, and they don't know them by rutabaga.
No,
but in this country we know them as rutabaga.
I always thought a rutabaga was actually different. There is a root crop called a rutabaga or rutabaga, but it's something different. And I don't really remember well enough what an English rutabaga looks like, but rutabagas are always considered
John.
like the he grew Swedes.
Oh, okay.
He grew Swedes, but a rutabaga was basically a Swede that could only be fed to animals. Sort of like the corn. There's a kind of corn that's grown in the United States that's only used as animal feed, not as human feed.
Ask any Italian about turnips, and they say that they only feed those to pigs.
That's a different issue altogether. So, and my next question is, why do you have two chapters on potatoes? You have one that starts with A,
right,
and then you have one that starts with P. Why did you draw that distinction?
Well, because Andean roots are so varied that potatoes are original to Peru,
yep,
and there's over 3,000 varieties. And so what we know as potato is such a narrow category compared to Andy and Tubers. And they have, beyond the potato, they also have something called ulecos, which are also indigenous to the Andean region. And I was able to get them canned. I couldn't get them fresh. But they're a stem tuber, and they have edible leaves. But the root is, interestingly enough, cross between a potato and a beet.
Okay, so
really?
So that's the reason. So it's a really kind of a, our potatoes as we know them, in, if you like, in the Western world and in Europe as well, are really derived from just a small subset of the Peruvian tubers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and so, and there's really, I saw a book just recently when I was in San Francisco, and it was in Spanish, and which is probably why I didn't run across it before. It was this very esoteric book, but it was all on Andean tubers, is an esoteric book. But it had, I don't know, it was over 100 varieties that they were showcasing in this book. And that variety doesn't even begin to exist in most of the countries outside of Peru. And so you have to, or at least outside of South America. So it's sort of, I needed to draw that distinction.
Now, you have this whole chapter on, we call them JAs.
Jerusalem artichokes?
Many years ago, my mother planted them in the back garden, and they grew, and they continued to spread, and they were the most invasive thing. And every year I vow, because they shave the tomatoes and whatnot, I vow to pull them out, and there'll still be something left in there, and we still get lots of them.
Yeah, I dig them out every year. I absolutely kill them every year, and they still come back. They're definitely they're very determined.
Yeah, but they're coming into season now, and they're very popular.
They're expensive too. I was really shocked.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, Whole Foods sells them for like $6 or $7 a pound.
Oh wow! Yeah, in our farmers market, they're not that expensive.
Hold on a second, because we need to get a piece of advice here. Diane may not be a farmer, but she probably knows better than we do. Anne's handed down family information is that you don't pick JAs until after the first frost.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's true with parsnips, too.
Okay. So one of the problems we have then is that usually by the time there's the first frost, it's so cold that the digger doesn't want to go out and dig.
Right.
So sometimes they sort of escape.
We wait until after the first frost, it brings out the natural sugars.
Well, I'll try again. I'll try again this year. I'll also try exterminating them again this year.
I like them raw in salad.
Yeah,
even.
But you don't like them growing in the garden.
No,
I have to get rid of them. I just don't know how. I've tried everything.
No, I'm really counting on your book here. What do you do? My husband thinks that all these things like
yucca
and jicama, they all taste like candle wax.
Well, all of these chapters, the chapter on jicama, has lots of recipes that really exploit the goodness of the root. I did a jicama and watermelon salad with Thai basil. And so I think it depends on how it's used and how you get to really enjoy it. And when you eat it raw, it really helps to toss the jicama with some salt and let it drain in a colander. And then you blot it dry. It firms up the texture and releases some of the moisture. So maybe that candle waxy flavor that you're getting will be removed. Something that I really noticed with that root. It doesn't really affect me that way. Doing the salting and letting it drain helps a lot.
Well, and this book, as I said, is a marvel. And it's staying close to my heart here in my little bookshelf. And I should mention that not only does it list all these roots alphabetically, tell you where they came from, what their characteristics are, also how to store them, and then the recipes, which are certainly delicious. So I wish you a lot of luck with this book, Diane, because it's just extraordinary. 225 recipes is a lot of recipes.
They actually trimmed down the number of recipes I'd submitted just because the book was running long.
Oh, they always do that, yes.
And so it was just very fun to explore for each root all the different ways it could be prepared.
Well, you did that, and again, congratulations to the photographer.
I have a feeling Roots Book 2 is not too far around the corner.
What more? You mean more recipes?
More roots, yeah. Secret roots or obscure roots.
Yeah.
roots that are buried from sight.
Yeah, there are some roots that I will give you, like what do they make tapioca out of?
Isn't it taro?
Taro.
Yeah,
that means
that's a little like candle wax to it.
Well, you know, I spent some time in the South Pacific, and that's basically the core of the diet, and it was not really very exciting.
Well, but it's, you know, it's the way in which they're used. They make terrific chips,
and they don't splatter
because they're so high in starch.
They are starchy.
Well, we congratulate you. We are particularly proud that we discovered that you're from our hometown. Our hometown is your hometown, the City of Champions, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Go Steelers, and I'm sure our paths will cross again.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we come to Portland a lot. So anyhow, so maybe we can meet.
All right.
Okay, thanks, Diane, and good luck on your book tour.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Before we go to break, I want to give you a test, and you can test yourself on the other side. What's America's most favorite dish? We have an interview all about it, so come back in a second and you'll see if you were right.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, what was your guess? If your guess was mac and cheese, you were right.
Yeah, well, Ellen Brown, she knew.
She knew the answer.
Yeah, you could never have too many recipes
for mac and cheese. But one thing we didn't know, and we think we know a lot, and probably do, we were humbled to know that macaroni and cheese is actually a fairly ancient dish.
It is.
Several centuries old. And there, you know, you thought you invented it. Anyway, let's hear more about it now.
Well, I want the history, Ellen Brown, of the dish mac and cheese, and also of your book, Mac and Cheese. I guess we should step back a little bit to say that you actually are a 30-year vet as a food writer, veteran food writer, right?
That's right. I was the founding food editor of USA Today.
Yeah, now how
and that
did that
was back
happen?
In the early 1980s. There in the Pleistocene era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
you must have known Al, huh?
Yes.
Al, who always wore black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I met him once, and I asked him if he'd ever talked to Rupert Murdoch, who at that time was famous for publishing The Australian.
Right.
And he said, yes, indeed, he had, and he got a lot of good ideas from Rupert when he launched USA Today.
Well, it was a very different take on daily journalism because rather than being worried about your little local market, I was tasked with finding national food trends. And I think that that's kind of the mindset that has stayed with me and is reflected in mac and cheese.
I'm glad you brought it back to what we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that because mac and cheese is timeless.
Well, mac and cheese is timeless, Peter, but also I'm constantly looking at trends that are happening nationally, and what's happened in the last, 5 years is that mac and cheese, which is, as we know it, a very American dish. In fact, Thomas Jefferson served it at the White House state dinner in 1802.
That's
oh, no kidding. That's amazing.
And he had learned about it when he was ambassador to France, and he commissioned someone to go to Italy and bring back to him at Monticello a machine to make dried pasta.
Oh, this Thomas Jefferson. The only problem with Thomas Jefferson is nobody liked him very much.
Well, I remember John Kennedy was giving out the first artistic awards at the White House, and it was in the East Room, and he said to the likes of Pablo Casals sitting there that such brilliance hadn't been in that room together since Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
That's really remarkable. But before we came on the air, I was telling you about my almost 50 years with mac and cheese, because in 1963, at a shared apartment in London, my flatmates and myself used to make mac and cheese every Wednesday. And Anne said it was a blue box, and I said, no, I'm pretty sure it was a red box. It's hard to imagine that a half-century anniversary of that is passing by very soon.
Indeed. And what happened in the first, kind of the first part of our century, is that Americans became very accustomed to very sophisticated Italian pasta dishes. You know, that the image of pasta being spaghetti and meatballs and a red sauce really went away, and people thought pasta with some seafood and with vegetables and really appreciated the nuances. But when it came to mac and cheese, because of either the blue box here or the red box that it was in London, people thought inexpensive kid food. And then chefs around the country started doing very sophisticated, subtle flavors with mac and cheese.
I keep running into it with lobster.
Oh, yes. In fact, I've got about 6 recipes for different lobster mac and cheese.
Yeah. You really the sophistication of yours is you actually make seafood stock and lobster stock.
Oh, yes. And they're also the American head for mac and cheese, you picture bright orange. So a color that basically never existed in nature.
Velveeta.
Well, Velveeta or American cheese, which are not cheeses, they are cheese products. And when you look at the recipes in my book, oh, you've got mac and cheese made with smoked Gouda. And a lot of them, I discovered that the really key to a fabulous mac and cheese is a combination of cheeses.
Okay.
So that you get a real complexity of flavor.
And truffle oil doesn't hurt.
Yes, there are about 4 recipes that you, instead of using a little melted butter in your crunchy topping, the oil product is truffle oil. And as far as I'm concerned, that turns anything into a special treat.
Now, you've taken, not only have you developed these 80 recipes, you've also been inspired by various restaurants and their versions. And what have you done? You've kind of refined those to present in the book?
Well, I spoke with a number of chefs who gave me their mac and cheese versions, some of which are just incredibly creative. My favorite ones is something called Mac Attack from a Straw restaurant in San Francisco. And it's mac and cheese with bacon and then diced apple on top.
Good grief.
Which gives it just wonderful crunchiness. But what's important to know is that all of these recipes that are inspired by these different restaurants have been tested so that these recipes will work in the home kitchen. They're going to work in your kitchen and my kitchen, even though they are adapted from a restaurant, they're now a good old-fashioned recipe.
Now, do you think a lot of people are uncertain about the basics of mac and cheese? Because there was one thing I thought that you had in the book. I can't remember that we did it this way, and I'm sure our mac and cheese was successful only in filling us with calories. You talk about pasta should be al dente, but it needs to be even more al or even more dente, because you're going to bake the mac and cheese once you've cooked the pasta. So you're going to par-cook the pasta.
There are basically 2 different subsets of mac and cheese recipes.
Okay.
There are recipes that you end up by baking in the oven, and then there are recipes that you finish in a skillet on the stove.
Okay, so depending on what you're doing, the al dente-ness of the pasta will vary.
And if you're going to be baking it, there are 2 things that make it a really successful mac and cheese. One is to really undercook your pasta. And the second is, because the pasta continues to cook in the oven and absorbs liquid, it should look really, really soupy when it goes in the oven.
Okay, because so you want there to be enough liquid.
It won't be soupy when it comes out of the oven, and your pasta that you think is really too hard will be just perfect al dente. In fact, my own niece called me last week very upset because she said, there is so much sauce in this casserole. Mm-hmm. And I said, right, that's the way it should look. But bake it in the oven, bring it out, and call me back. And she called me back and said, it's now totally perfect.
So there you go. Now, you also say use dry pasta. Don't even think about making your own because it won't be as successful.
It won't be.
And you like certain shapes. I mean, we ought to mention that you do a rundown, sort of a primer on appropriate cheeses. And also, in fact, I had never thought of using a blue cheese, but you have that in there too. And also the different pasta shapes.
Yes, because there are, again, to give some variety to the book, I used probably about 8 or 9 different pasta shapes. So I give you a chart with what they look like, and you can substitute any of them for each other.
Now, you've also been innovative because I saw the first section of the book is mac and cheese's finger food, which is certainly not how I would have thought of it.
Well, I love turning things into creative finger foods. And a few ideas kind of led me to this whole chapter. One is I think that the miniature muffin pan is a great item which is really underutilized. And almost any mac and cheese in the book, you can pack into those little miniature muffin tins, bake it in a hot oven, and it's a wonderful little two-bite canapé.
Now, my mother used to use her baking pan like that to make Yorkshire pudding, which is...
Yes, of
course.
She's talking about much smaller ones.
So disgustingly non-traditional.
Rabbit, she's talking about...
Oh, she's talking about even smaller ones?
Yeah, okay. Oh, much, much smaller.
These are an inch and a half across.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
And the other thing is there's a fabulous Italian hors d'oeuvre that I love, arancini.
Which is usually
done with leftover risotto, and there's a cube of mozzarella put in the middle, and then you fry them. Well, to go to all the trouble of making risotto to have a leftover really didn't make much sense to me. And I discovered that if you used orzo, which is a rice-shaped pasta, you could do a wonderful orzo arancini, and it takes just a fraction of the time.
Now, isn't that cheating? No, that's not macaroni.
Well, it's a pasta.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're extending the definition of what's allowed.
She really pushes the envelope. Here's mac and cheese spring rolls. That I would never have expected. And tell us, the other thing that really knocked my socks off was desserts.
Once again, we think about, didn't we all grow up with rice pudding?
Sure.
Well, there's some wonderful ways you can do a macaroni pudding. And I grew up in New York where everyone used to eat this Eastern European dish called noodle kugel.
Oh, yeah, kugel.
Which was egg noodles and different kinds of cheese and eggs baked. And decided to update that. And actually, one of the most fun recipes in the book, I think, is my contemporary adaptation of tuna noodle casserole.
Oh, yes.
Now.
Go ahead.
Now, Peter, you may have escaped this because you were in England, but my guess is that Anne and me and everybody who was old enough to remember when John Kennedy was president remembers ladies with hairnets dishing out tuna noodle casserole.
I have heard of it. I think it's been inflicted on me a couple of times.
Okay.
It was long enough ago that my memory has faded. And
you've repressed it. It was done with egg noodles that were usually overcooked and a can of cream of mushroom soup.
That's it, cream of mushroom soup.
And, of course, a can of tuna fish, right?
Yes. In the case of my version, you make a bechamel sauce that's flavored with a lot of dried porcini mushrooms.
Oh, that sounds heavenly.
Then you sauté a lot of celery and onion. But the only nod to the prototype is I did put crushed potato chips on top.
But how can
right.
How can you call it tuna noodle casserole when that's what you do?
Well, whether she's pushing the envelope, as I said, or not, the recipes are really attractive and appetizing, and I think people would have so much fun, Ellen, playing with this. All these variations on an old cast, on an old classic.
I think that just as in music, where you have to know the classics and then you can start to improvise jazz, with cooking, a genre like mac and cheese, you may think you know it, but when you look at all the possibilities that are out there with all of these fabulous cheeses from around the world and different inclusions. I mean, one of my favorites is there's a sweet onion mac and cheese, and the basis for the sauce is really a French sous-vide sauce done with caramelized onion, and I think it's just heavenly.
Well, there's so many of these are enticing, and endless variety. Fajita mac and cheese, and creamy leek, and what else? Parisian mac and cheese with shiitake mushrooms and figs.
Well, that's one of my favorites.
Oh. Well, I must say that people are going to have fun with this, and isn't it going to be a wonderful present?
I hope so, because another thing about mac and cheese is, in today's day and age, it's still affordable.
Right.
You know, even with the lobster mac and cheese recipes, you only need a little bit of lobster meat.
Well, I'm going to ask you one question before we go, because we must say goodbye. How many times a week do you eat mac and cheese, Ellen Brown?
Well, I will tell you that when you first finish a cookbook, think to yourself, will I ever want to eat this food again?
Yep, I get it.
But now that the book, I actually turned the book in almost a year ago, and after about a month, I started making mac and cheese again, and even this summer, whenever we would be having kind of a community potluck here in my neighborhood, it was always, and you can bring the mac and cheese, Ellen.
If you came to my house, I'd have you bring some, too. I'd have you bring your favorite.
No, I'm going to challenge you to cook from this book.
Oh, you're going to challenge me? I have to cook from a dessert book. I have all kinds of new cooking things I have to do.
Cooking from my book will make you have a new appreciation of mac and cheese over your flatmates in London in the 60s.
Well, I better get off the phone and into the kitchen. Ellen Brown, what a pleasure to talk to you today.
How much fun talking to you, Ellen.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
And before we move on to cookies, let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and now moving on, a doubly sweet ending to the program. To start with, it's a book, not just cookies, it's desserts in general, by Hetty Goldsmith, and it has a perfect title called Cooking Out Loud.
Actually, I think it's Baking Out Loud.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Baking Out Loud.
Baking.
But never mind. Don't be so fussy, Peter. And then Nancy Bagot.
Cookies.
And what Nancy Bagot doesn't know about cookies isn't worth knowing.
Right.
So we hope you'll enjoy these fine ladies back-to-back, and the conclusion of the program, we'll be right back to say goodbye.
Hetty Goldsmith has found the perfect title for her brand-new cookbook, and probably for her attitude towards baking. It's called Baking Out Loud, Fun Desserts with Big Flavors. And, Hetty, they look absolutely scrumptious.
Oh, thank you.
The gist of this is, of course, fun and big flavors. That's one of your signatures.
Right.
You have, among other things, you have really really handy tips for bakers, which, I mean, for me, as a novice baker, I think that probably I would rely very heavily on these tips.
Well, that's really what I wanted to appeal to, the home baker that could really, really enjoy baking at a pastry chef level, but much more attainable. You can read the tips, you can follow the directions, you can bake like a pastry chef.
Yeah, now you update in one section things that we grew up with eating, but you made them adult and exciting again. Could you give us some examples?
Sure. Well, I reinvented the Twinkie. Kind of, I took the idea of the Twinkie, that little filled cake that's shaped like a canoe, and the red velvet cake, which we all know and love, which is that really delicious chocolate cake that has a red tint to it, and I put the two together, and I, instead of using a cream cheese icing, I mixed half cream cheese with goat cheese. So it adds a little bit of a tangy kind of frosting, not as cloyingly sweet as cream cheese frosting. It's a little play on classic, but I think it's really very current in terms of flavors and textures and just how we thought of things as a kid. We would never eat goat cheese, but now as adults we would.
And take it one step further, your little tip is try adding some chopped up bacon praline to the filling. Now that's exciting.
Well, I think everything tastes better with bacon anyway, so absolutely.
Some of the others that you've updated here is you made your own Pop-Tarts, and they really look like something I'd eat. They don't look like that awful stuff they sell.
Yeah, that's true.
And Peter loves your tip about...
That's the one where you need... I was actually reminded of this by seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger on Feet the Press yesterday. He looks pretty awful. But he would be able to execute the tip that you have in mind for making a crimping tool.
Oh. I wondered where you were going with that one, Robin.
That's exactly.
Let us in on the secret.
Tell us about your crimper.
Well, right, you don't have to be the incredible Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator to do that. You actually take a fork and put it in a vice grip and bend it 90 degrees. The reason we do that is because when I make Pop-Tarts, it's so much easier to crimp the edges of the Pop-Tart if the tines are at a 90-degree angle. This way you hold the fork straight up and down, and you just pinch the edges of it. Pop-Tarts are really something that I grew up with and loved as a kid, and it didn't matter about the flavor. I actually like brown sugar cinnamon. But what I do with the Pop-Tarts now is I take really just all butter dough, and I roll it very thin, and I add, this is the key ingredient, really good jam. I make all of my own jams with whatever's growing. I live in South Florida, so we have mango season and strawberry season.
Wow.
And passion fruit. So I get to utilize all those wonderful flavors, but it can certainly be made with apple jam. It can be made with a really good store-bought jam. It can be made with lemon curd, which I did in Los Angeles for Alex's Lemonade Stand. And there are so many variations of it, but the real key to making a good Pop-Tart is using good, fresh ingredients.
Well, I don't know which of these. They all look so good. I don't know which to pick out. Particularly, I like the little side thing. This is the giant sesame fortune cookies. And your little fortune is a slip of paper that says, eat dessert first.
that's the pastry chef motto, eat dessert first, because we want everyone to save room for us. So if they eat it first, we'll ensure that everybody tastes something sweet. The fortune cookies were a fun idea, fun, playful idea, and I thought Sunday growing up I would eat Chinese food with my parents, and the food was so insignificant, but what I most loved was the vanilla ice cream and the fortune cookies, and I was always fascinated by the way it was folded, and I thought, wow, if I could just let everyone in on the secret of how to fold this very simple cookie to make, what a great thing. Someone that's proposing marriage could, I don't know, at the end of the dinner, give the woman a fortune cookie and have her crack it open and say, will you marry me, or birthday parties, or just imagine the possibilities that you can make these great cookies in your home, and it's just, they're fun. They're so much fun. They can convey all kinds of messages.
I'd love to get inside your head to find out where these ideas come from. I'm looking at peanut butter curry ice cream. How would you ever get to that?
A lot of my inspiration comes from the savory world. I started in this industry as a savory cook, and I absolutely love the flavors, the exotic flavors of Morocco, of India, of Southeast Asia, and these flavors actually play very well together in the sandbox. Peanut butter and curry is fantastic, and what I wrote in the header is, if you're really not so crazy about peanut butter curry ice cream, you can always melt it down and pour it over tandoori chicken. That's just kind of my that's kind of my little playful nod to it. This is such a great ice cream. The curry just adds a real different layer and level of flavor. It's not so curry in your face. It's just a really nice level of flavor. It has flavors that you wouldn't associate with dessert, and yet it works so well with the ice cream. And pair that with a delicious chocolate dessert or a coconut dessert, banana dessert. It can go in so many directions. And it's delicious without the curry also. Or you can add coconut and ginger to it, and you can have coconut ginger curry peanut butter ice cream, which is from out of this world. So there are a lot of, I want the home baker to be able to express a cool, kooky, fun, creative side and not be afraid to do that, because you really don't need to take a risk. You just need to follow the recipe with it, because, you know, I've taken all the risks. I've tasted all the recipes. They're all fantastic. It's just a matter of where you want to go with that recipe. So I encourage everyone to use their creative part and have fun with these desserts.
Did you actually test it out on home cooks? I mean, did you get three or four people that you knew who could cook just a little bit but not a whole lot and have them try?
Actually, I've taken a full range of different home bakers, people that really have never baked before, given them the challenge, and friends of mine who are home bakers that really should be professional bakers. So it went the full gamut, and everyone, I distributed all the recipes, and we did it very systematically. Everybody baked the same thing the same day, and we collected them, we tasted them, we talked about it, we talked about oven settings, different types of ovens. And it was really interesting because we all took notes, and then everybody switched their notes with the next person. So we went through this drill several times, and I had the most incredible results, and I learned a lot from that process.
Now, here's the thing, listeners. You didn't hear this because it was off the air while we were still getting ready to start the broadcast. But Hedy challenged me. She said, "Are you a cook?" And I said,
"She said, are you a baker?"
And I said, "I'm not much of a baker, that's for sure." But apparently the gauntlet has been thrown down.
Oh, no.
I am now required to start cooking desserts.
Oh, dear.
So, okay.
So
Peter, I think you better start.
Yeah, but he was raised in the U.K., where, you know, the ultimate sweet tooth exists.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. I mean, then he lost his sweet tooth, and now it's coming back. I find him lifting chocolate syrups out of little jars with a spoon, and it goes like
it's
a
it's really good.
It's really good.
Chase down a little hot pepper jam.
Yeah.
With a couple of spoonfuls of...
I love that.
He might be your kind of a baker, Hedy.
I think so.
Well, actually, Peter, I was introduced to something really delicious. We have a restaurant in Grand Cayman Island, and there are a lot of expats there, and they introduced me to Maltesers and several of the candies from the UK, and I've been having a lot of fun baking with some of those candies. They're really pretty delicious. Cadbury is very delicious in the UK.
Yeah, I never liked Maltesers, but I think it's because for what you got, they were pretty expensive.
What are they?
They're
malt balls?
Yeah, they're malt balls.
Malty balls.
Covered in chocolate.
Yeah, I used to like this.
Yeah, my mother used to absolutely adore a chocolate bar from Switzerland, I think, called Toblerone.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
You've probably seen that in the Grand Cayman. If the Brits are there, their Toblerone will follow, as will their Rolos.
Smarties.
Smarties and Kit Kat.
Yep. And your Violet Crumbles in the UK.
Anne actually thought that Kit Kats were invented in the United States.
I wised
up to that one.
You seem to have this passion for popcorn, Hedy,
I love popcorn.
Yeah, see, I do too, but you don't usually find it that popular with pastry chefs.
You also don't usually have it with gelato. But
buttered popcorn gelato. But that's only one. You have a bunch of recipes. What are some of the others?
I do. I have my nod to Cracker Jacks, which is absolutely delicious. It's popcorn and peanuts covered in a really rich caramel that the spice, it could have a number of different flavors. You can serve it for a cocktail party with drinks, you know, salty and sweet. You can serve it as a little complement to at the end of the meal. It's really got the full range. I also do a popcorn and peanut bark, which is covered in really rich
dark chocolate, and it's absolutely divine. You can store that in the refrigerator and kind of nibble that secretly at night when you're when the family's asleep.
Okay.
Really great. And my most favorite thing in the book, I think, is the buttered popcorn gelato, because secretly I sneak away to a afternoon matinee and buy a huge tub of popcorn, and I would rather skip a meal than actually I would rather have a bowl of popcorn than a meal. So it's really kind of my homage to a big barrel of buttered popcorn. It's yummy.
Well, I can say this, that anybody who wants to be inspired to a more adventurous sweet taste and a combination of sweet and savory and a lot of high wire tour de force that's still accessible because of the way Hetty describes the process, get this book, and it's then called Baking Out Loud, Fun Desserts with Big Flavors by Hetty Goldsmith. Hetty, do you have a website too?
I do. Hetty Goldsmith. You can reach me at HettyGoldsmith.com. You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Instagram, Facebook.
Oh, you're a busy lady.
I'm a busy lady, absolutely. I'm having fun. You can follow me on the Cooking Channel. I'm a contributor to Unique Sweet. I'm on the Cooking Channel. I write a blog for Food Network. I'm a busy lady. I'm busy having fun.
Oh, well, that's great.
And we hope things are well in Miami.
Fantastic.
And you'll continue to prosper with your career down there. And when you write your next book, you'll be in touch and let us know.
Fantastic, Peter. Thank you. And next time, I hope you can tell me that you've tackled at least one of the recipes.
Absolutely.
I'm afraid you're going to do it.
I wouldn't dare speak to you again if I hadn't done that.
That's a deal.
Hetty, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're welcoming back to a previous guest, Nancy Baggett. We interviewed you when you wrote the book Needlessly Simple. Yeah, now you have Simple again, but this one is Simply Sensational Cook.
That's correct. Yeah. And I really wanted Simple to be part of the story. I know that more and more people are pressed for time, and so instead of in Grandma's Day where people set aside all day to bake, they now can set aside half an hour.
Yeah, you say here that you have bright, fresh flavors, natural colors, and easy, streamlined techniques, which
correct.
You're going to tell us about.
I am. Well, for example, there's a recipe in the very first chapter, which is devoted to extra easy. And I like the flavor of hazelnuts, for example.
I do, too.
Hazelnuts are a bit of a pain in the neck to deal with.
Exactly.
If you aren't fortunate enough to go online and go to the trouble of getting the ones that are already pre-hulled and pre-toasted, then you have to put them in the oven, and then you have to let them cool, and then you have to peel off the peels and the hulls. And so that cookie, it's called Nutella's Three Ways.
Yeah, I'm looking right at it. It's
beautiful. Yep, and it's a nice picture. And as you can see from the picture, you can do a plain wafer chocolate cookie. I say plain in quotes because it's chocolate and hazelnut,
yes.
And, of course, with a goodly portion of Nutella to bring up that hazelnut flavor. And then if you want, you can take two cookies and sandwich them together and make a sandwich cookie using more Nutella. And if you want to go even a step further, one combination that I really like in addition to chocolate and hazelnut is adding in some raspberry jam. And so you can roll those same cookies into balls, push them down with a thumb, and put a little jam in the center. And so you've really got three options. And, of course, with the jam in the center, they're very festive for the holidays, as being tasty.
These look good enough to eat. I'm sure they are. And I mentioned Diane Q and Todd Porter, who were the photography team on this. And they've done some really fantastic work.
They really have. They're extremely talented. Also, I did want to communicate the notion of fresh flavors and fresh natural colors, and we can talk about the natural colors. You won't see any commercial sprinkles in the book. I give some alternatives that don't use the food dyes to the extent that are normally seen. You can use them.
And no maraschino cherries. Aren't they the worst?
None of those either.
Are they not plastic?
well, they're close to it, yes. But I'm actually allergic to the red dye, which is what got me started with the all-natural. But to get back to Todd and Diane, they were just a joy to work with. They're so talented, and they have a fresh kind of vibe to their photography, which, and beautiful, clear colors, and everything looks so natural and not overdone, and yet also very beautiful. And so it was a real pleasure to work with them. And they're also a lot of fun and very welcoming. They're based in California, and I'm in Maryland, so I actually flew out and worked with them in their kitchen for, well, it was supposed to be 5 days, but a hurricane got in the way, so it was so it was actually 4 days. My flight was canceled to go out on a Sunday, and I had to go out on a Monday instead. But we worked like little beavers for a week, and I think the photography is very beautiful.
Now we won't ask what the total compensation for them was, but what percentage was it in cookies?
Oh, a lot of it was in cookies. But really, a lot of it was in cookies. When I left, I took home one kind. There were like just cookies all over the studio, and they were giving them to the mailman and to the people next door and friends and relatives. I did bring back, I think, one kind that was a favorite of my hubby, who'd been here kind of batching it all week. So I brought some home for him, but yes, they got paid heavily in cookies.
Now, your introduction says, times change, people change, cookies do too. Tell us about that.
I have written another cookie book, actually way back when, another cookie book even before that. And so the last one, someone asked me, well, how's this new one different from the last one? And I said, well, it kind of had Hallmark recipes and lauded the past and celebrated the traditional cookies. And this time, I wanted to do some new things. For example, there's nothing really weird, but there are some flavor combinations that I've seen for a while. For example, lavender is really a beautiful flavor. I use it in this beautiful, fresh lavender buttercream, and people who think that it might be like eau de cologne or something are really surprised.
You know, I cook with it. We have two lavender bushes in the back garden.
Yes.
I do savory with it, too.
It's wonderful. Yes, you can do savory with it. So I use it both in cookies and I use it in buttercream. And it's got a slightly floral flavor, but it's almost a spicy kind of flavor, especially if you mix it with lemon, for example. I actually took chocolate in some new directions. If you add a little bit of heat to it, it's so that you get almost that same kind of heat that you get when you have a very spicy ginger cookie. If you add a little cayenne or maybe a little extra ginger to chocolate, you can bring up some dimension. There's a cookie called Chocolate Mole Cookies.
And, oh, yes.
And it has a little bit of the spices that you would find in a mole. And it may sound a little out there, but really the flavors work beautifully. So I want to capitalize on some of the new flavor combinations people are now using, as I did in several recipes, fresh grated ginger instead of dried ginger. And I just learned the other day why it makes such a difference. Apparently, I was at a conference and someone mentioned that when you dry ginger, some of the flavor components that make it really wonderful actually are diminished. Mm-hmm. So both grating a little into some ginger cookies will give them extra zip. And you can use dry ginger too, but adding a little grated fresh ginger and adding it into a ginger lime buttercream, for example, or a ginger orange buttercream. Oh, boy, that makes the greatest cookie filling. So anyway, I wanted to do some new things, but I also wanted to update some of the classics. For example, I have two or three plain, I'd say that in quotes, plain chocolate chip cookies. One is called Ultimate One Bowl Chocolate Chip or Chunk Cookies. And indeed, because you do mix everything in one bowl, and you have the option of using whatever premium chocolate chunks you want, although I do give you a tip, don't want to use the super high cocoa butter fat ones because they will melt the cookies. So I give little tips to how to make whatever you're doing work for you, but if you use a good quality semi or bittersweet chocolate chunk, you can throw that in instead of the chocolate chips and really customize. And of course, the fact that it's all stirred together in one bowl makes cleanup simple. And there is one other thing that makes it simple. In many of the recipes, I do streamline by not having people have to cream the butter. That's the old-fashioned technique of putting the slightly cool butter in a bowl and then beating it with the sugar until it's light, fluffy. I do away with that in a lot of recipes, and you get actually a more intense flavor. And in the case of a chocolate chip cookie or even a chocolate cookie, sometimes you want a more intense brown sugar or chocolate flavor. So there's a lot of beat-it-up techniques to slim down the mess and fuss and also to make sure that you can get in and out of the kitchen. There's actually a couple of no-bake and semi-homemade chapters that facilitate making cookies but doing it, you know, in it with a time crunch.
I might point out, by the way, that because I didn't say so in the introduction, that, I mean, you've been at this for a long time. I mean, not only as a baker and cookie expert, but as a food journalist, you've written 14 cookbooks?
Actually, I've actually written several more than that that I co-authored with people. So, yes, I've been at it for a long time. And, in fact, my baking experience goes back to when I was a small child. I can count myself very fortunate in that I'm one of those lucky people who grew up with bakers in the family. And when I was little, I remember there was a certain excitement around the holidays, because around Thanksgiving and certainly before Christmas, my aunt and my mother and my grandmother would all get together in the kitchen. And I was still pretty small when I first remember it. And I felt so important to be part of the getting ready for the holidays. And so they would make not just cookies, all kinds of, you know, fruit cakes, which really weren't my favorite, but my aunt had a fruitcake she liked, and we'd make gingerbread boys and sugar cookies, and my grandmother had this wonderful date with cinnamon and cloves. And so whenever I bake today, I still think of them and the wonderful times that we had. And then when I got married, my husband's mother and grandmother were big cookie bakers. So we really have the tradition in our family today from both sides of the family.
Well, we have the tradition, but I've never learned to bake.
Oh, gosh. Well, maybe some of the easy recipes in the book will tempt.
Yeah, you have on each recipe, it tells you the degree of difficulty.
Correct.
And then at least one tip, sometimes even more than one. Probably can't go too far astray with this book, Nan.
You really can't. In fact, I think there's only one fairly complicated or complicated recipe. If you look at the, like you say, at the top of each recipe at the left, it points out the features in some cases, like the Nutellas I was mentioning, where you can actually take the same dough and make three different cookies. It'll say versatile recipe. If it happens to be something that is gluten-free, it will say that. Because I was interested in using natural flavors and natural colors from fruit and berries instead of artificial dyes that you get in the little bottles, I really wanted to avoid those myself, although in some cases I say if you want to use them, you feel free to do it. But I do give options, and at the top of those recipes, I will say au naturel, meaning that in the, as the French say, in the natural manner. And that might be, for example, in the very back, there is a recipe that, several that I'm very proud of, but one, for example, you can make, because I do bake with my grandkids and they like all the colors, but I didn't want them eating a lot of the dyes from the little bottles. Although you can get organic ones that are fine health-wise and not allergy-promoting, but in the back there's actually a whole set of colors that you can make using powdered sugar, very easy powdered sugar icing recipe, only instead of adding in the dyes, you add in cranberry juice concentrate or grape juice concentrate or orange juice concentrate or a combination or maybe cocoa powder, and you can get this beautiful array of colors. And if you look through the book, you'll see that there's a daisy cookies featured several places.
Very cute, yes.
And they're very cute, and my grandkids love to make them. They're easy enough that they can make them. And all of those dyes are from natural fruit and berry dyes. So that was a point that I wanted to
stress. I often wanted to do, or I frequently think of doing, never have, a whole Easter egg dyeing thing using all those natural colors.
And, sure.
Yeah. And
you can,
red cabbage is a great color.
You can.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the commercial dye makers that are doing vegan and gluten-free and allergy-free and all of that, there are several manufacturers that have brands out there, and in fact, for those who are interested, I actually tell what the brands are and what their products are and how to go find their products online if you're interested. Some are sold in stores, but some are hard to find unless you go online. Because the point that some of the health advocates are making is that more and more food that we buy, in fact, they've figured out that or suggest that we're eating like 30, 40, 50 times more of it than we were I was a child. And I happen to know that I'm allergic to the red one, so I wanted to give some alternatives.
Well, Nancy, I'll tell you, it's that time of year, and to get a little ahead, people should be getting this book and starting with their holiday treats right now. It's called Simply Sensational Cookies, and they are. And it's Nancy Baggett, and we're delighted to have had you back again, Nancy.
Thank you, Anne. It's fun to talk to you about my favorite subject. Happy baking to you and to everybody else for the holidays.
And we'll be here, same time, same place next week. We hope you will be too, and until then...
Bye-bye.